Sponsorship for this KQED live audio stream comes from Brevo, helping businesses work smarter, not harder, to help deliver customer experiences across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. Learn more at brevo.com. That's brevo.com.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming out to our event today on this beautiful Berkeley day. This event is going to start off with the concept of WikiLeaks. And as many of you may notice from the advertisement, it said WikiLeaks to the Pentagon Papers, which some of you may notice is in reverse chronological order. But part of the reason that we wanted to do that is not only because we're going to end the day with a panel that includes Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers and then the film about him, but also because whenever I hear people talking about WikiLeaks, and by the way, my name is Jason Schultz. I'm the co-director of the Samuelson Law Technology and Public Policy Clinic at the law school. I'm going to be playing MC today. Whenever I hear people talk about WikiLeaks, it's sort of interesting because there are a lot of emotions that I think come up. Some people are inspired, some people are angry, some people are scared, some people are confused, some people are intrigued. There are a lot of folks who have sort of feelings about what happens with this platform, with this information, and then a lot of questions that come from it, a lot of intuitions about what's right and what's wrong. And so we wanted to have an event that explored some of those with people who basically work on these issues for a living, to give a little more depth, to give some breadth, and some reflection on the phenomenon itself and the implications, and to explore some of the questions about, is there anything new here? And if so, what should we think about it? And we're going to be hearing from folks throughout the day who come from different disciplines and different professions. So we have those who come from law, those who deal with the political sphere and diplomacy, those who come from library and library sciences, those who come from political science, computer science, those who come from the world of business and corporate responsibility, and those who come from journalism. And one of the interesting things I like about this group of speakers that we're going to have is that there is a rigor to many of these disciplines, a way of approaching problems and understanding them, and there's also a series of ethics that each of them bring in terms of how they do their jobs. And the questions around WikiLeaks are involving ethics, involving rigor, involving what we should actually take away from what's happened, I think are at the heart of this controversy. So we have, as most of you can probably tell from the program, we have a series of panels that we'll go, we have two go back to back, then we'll take a break and have a final panel, and then we'll have the film showing. And the panels are going to focus on various aspects, but I think you'll see that there's a lot of crossover. They're going to look at issues of transparency and accountability and whether that creates tension with diplomacy and deliberation by government officials and others who play a role in our political sphere. They're going to look at accountability of the platforms themselves and what does it mean that these might be privately created platforms but have a very large public presence, especially online. And then finally, some of the tensions between our desires to have national security be strong, but also to have a society that respects free speech. Before I introduce our first moderator and then she introduces the panel, I did want to make a few announcements. The restrooms are out and to your left, always important to know. Also that we did have over 200 people register for this event, so we already have a great turnout, but I expect more people to be coming in. So if you have the chance to squeeze in fact, right now would be a great time if you don't mind getting a little closer to your neighbor, but if you see other people come in, just be prepared to squeeze in so that we can get everyone in, because we are actually expecting that we might end up with a full house, and I want to make sure there's a seat for everyone. I'd like to thank David Grady right there and Louise Lee, two of our phenomenal staff members of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology who make these events amazing every time. Everything comes together, and David in particular did a fantastic job. We're going to have a multi-technology interface with Skype and slides and everything, and if it wasn't for his great work and Louise's great work, none of this would be possible. So thank you, David. And then finally, I'd like to just give a short shout out to the sponsors of the event, because I believe this is the first time all of us have worked together on this kind of an event, and it's actually been exciting. So in addition to the Law School and the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology, the UC Berkeley School of Information is a sponsor, the ACLU of Northern California.
Okay.
Fans in the audience, that's excellent, yeah. It's your free speech right, they'll defend your right to clap. In addition to KQED, and so this has actually been a really great collaboration among all these organizations, and I really appreciate that we got the opportunity to do that. So with that, I'm going to introduce our first moderator, who is then going to take over and introduce her panel. Nicole Ozer is the Technology and Civil Liberties Policy Director for the ACLU of Northern California, and her work spans many different technologies, looking at everything from online speech and privacy issues with Facebook and things like that, to radio frequency ID tags, to all kinds of aspects of our lives where technology, privacy, online civil liberties interface. But I'm most proud of Nikki because she is also a Bolt grad and was one of our first and most successful students in the Samson Clinic, where we train students to think about public policy issues, to think about public interest issues, including civil liberties, and to sort of start them on their way into careers where they might be able to have that kind of broad impact. And so I'm particularly proud to have Nikki here as one of our moderators, because she has great knowledge and great passion for these issues. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nikki.
Thanks so much, Jason. And thanks to all of you for joining us today, and particularly being here early for our first panel, which is really exploring the balance between transparency and accountability and diplomacy and deliberation. And we have a wonderful panel today. We have, as Jason said, quite a mix of disciplines, and we'll have hopefully a good opportunity for the panelists to both give a little bit of an introduction to their perspectives on these issues, and then have a discussion between the panelists about their thoughts about what each other has said, and then also to open it up to you in the audience for some of your questions, we hope to do as well. So start thinking about those as you're hearing the panelists speak. I'm going to introduce the panelists very briefly, starting with Steve Weber, who is on the end, who is both a professor in the Department of Political Science here at Berkeley, as well as in the School of Information, and he's been a professor here at Berkeley since 1989. And he is really an international relations specialist with an expertise on international and national security. And for those of you who have not yet picked up his book, The End of Arrogance, America in the Global Competition of Ideas, that was published in 2010. So I encourage you all to take a look at that. Next, we have Sarah Mohammed, who is a professor here at UC Berkeley School of Law. And she really works in the areas of international law, human rights, and international criminal law. And she also was formerly at the State Department, so she'll be able to give us some context for some of these WikiLeaks documents. We have James Jacobs, who is the government information librarian at Stanford University, and he is actually the co-founder of the Free Government Information website and is the chair of the Depository Library Council, and really works on these issues with the American Library Association. So he is a librarian and has really spent quite a long career looking at issues of how to archive government data and make government data available to the public. So great to have him. And I want to thank him for coming in at the last minute to join us on this panel. As you may notice, he's not in the in the brochure, but we thank him for joining us. And then we will actually, we will be modeling today how technology can really increase access to information by having Carlos Osorio on our panel, actually joining us by Skype. The weather on the East Coast has impacted Carlos's ability to be here in person, but I'm sure that will not dampen his energy around this issue and his ability to share information with you all. He is the Information Systems Manager and Director of the Southern Cone Documentation Project in the National Security Archive. And he has really been, he's been an advisor on access to information and the ability of making information public with the secret police in Paraguay, the secret police archive in Buenos Aires, and the Uruguayan Network for Access to Information. So he's an exiled activist for peace and democracy, and we'll be talking about the importance of transparency to movements and to accountability and transparency. So as you can see, we have quite the lineup today, and hopefully they will really spark ideas amongst each other and amongst the audience. And with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Carlos, who we will hear via Skype audio, and I will be directing his slides. So you will get the audio-visual experience through teamwork today. So I'm going to let Carlos know that we are ready for him to start speaking, and then I will be moving his slides. So, Carlos,
yes.
I'm going to leave it to you.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me well?
Maybe a little bit louder.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
That is very good.
Okay, good. I'll try to talk louder. Thank you. Thank you very much. I can hear you right now very well. Let me just tell you that I couldn't hear when you were speaking in the other mic, not the person I introduced everything as well. But that's okay. Let us deal with it.
I would say all right. Very nice things about you, Carlos. So.
Oh, okay. Oh, I was expecting to. Listen. All right. Let me just dive into it. I wanted to reflect on transparency and accountability, the issue of transparency and accountability, and diplomacy and deliberation. This is what it produced and produced in my spirit and with other colleagues at the National Security Archive. Let me begin by saying this. This is how I'll just dive in. It took the National Security Archive to fight with three administrations in the courts up to the Supreme Court before the government released the White House emails during the Iran-Contra. Slide one. Often these declassifications show the capriciousness of what is blacked out. Here you see the same document is declassified in diametrically opposed ways at the same time. Most of the time, what is classified is embarrassing, but not a threat to national security. The project I direct at the National Security Archive took 2 years to find the evidence of existence of a key, very old document and consultations with archivists at the National Archives in 2010. To get declassified a secret Exodus Department of State cable dated in 1970, almost 40 years after written. Slide two, please. The document shows the Nixon administration asking the Uruguayan government to threaten guerrilla prisoners with death in order to save an American police advisor withheld by leftist guerrillas there. For the past 10 years, we have been feeding these documents to relatives of victims, prosecutors, and judges in Uruguay, struggling to bring to trial former presidents and chiefs of intelligence and defense under the dictatorship in the 1970s. It has taken the ACLU hundreds of our person, lawyers, and FOIA efforts to get to the docket of Guantanamo detainees. Yet the record was not complete, and WikiLeaks released a cache 2 days ago that is crucial for the public to understand which prisoners are real threats that you may not want in the prison in your state, and how many have been wrongfully withheld without trial. After a brief declassification spring under the Clinton administration, when more documents were declassified in 8 years than in all the time before or after, slide three, today the FOIA and access to information processes pertaining to sensitive and currently crucial national security, foreign policy and defense matters is stalling, failing its purpose as President Johnson intended to mention when he signed the act in 1966, he said, to make sure that the United States is an open society in which the decisions and policies, as well as the mistakes of the public officials, are always subjected to the scrutiny and judgment of the people. No one in the government has a precise picture of how many FOIA requests are being delayed. How big is the backlog? The estimate runs at around hundreds of thousands. The public seems to be discouraged by the system, and the number of FOIA requests have been dropping. Requests that should be responded in 20 days get a response in 6 months, a year with luck. But you could be waiting 3 to 5 years with agencies like the Defense Intelligence Agency, or 15 or more years with the CIA. When you get a response, there are good chances that you will be denied documents or offered blacked out, senseless versions. The situation is similar at the National Archives, where automatic declassification of documents deemed to be of historical relevance are being reviewed. The backlog there is 400 million pages, mainly from the 1940s to the 1970s, and growing. The problem is exacerbated in the digital era, with 32 million emails from the Clinton administration and 250 million emails from the Bush administration. It is estimated that it would take 100 people working year-round 54 years to review all the material. The key problem is that each page has to be reviewed by a battery of political and security officials, particularly from the CIA, to make sure that no secret escapes. According to people who work in this, in average, it takes a team of 3 people one day to review 400 pages. The problem is of such magnitude that some at the government are contemplating declassifying records in bulk. What does all this have to do with WikiLeaks? Well, everything. To begin with a cable released by WikiLeaks showing how some government officials, rather than protecting deliberation, are set in a culture of not dealing with the consequences of their agency's actions, not from 6 months ago, from 40 years ago. Slide 4. In December 2006, an Irish US ambassador back there in Uruguay writes a cable titled, "Left Using Human Rights to Discredit Us." And he said, "Recently declassified US documents from the period around the Uruguayan dictatorship had fueled the fire of leftist critics reminding public opinion of the US role in the 1970s in Uruguay." The ambassador concludes, "There may come a time when we might need to defend ourselves against this assault on US credibility and intention." Talk about an overreaction to 40-year-old documents. The cable caused a stir last December when it was released by WikiLeaks in Uruguay, where the country is set on to clarifying the human rights violations of the dictatorship in the 1970s. In particular, many organizations, including the Uruguayan government, discussed asking for more declassification of US documents to help the country come to terms with its murky past. Similarly, the reaction of the US government to the WikiLeaks cable has been an overreaction. There has not been so much talk diplomatic meltdown. Many diplomats writing in different media have stated how pleased some would be that finally their papers get aired. The image in this cable of US policymakers comes out enhanced, savvy, and meticulous in most of the cables. There are diplomatic consequences, of course, like the removal of ambassadors in Mexico or Ecuador, or the planned phone conversation with the Indonesian president. But overall, everyone expects that things will settle down. You all know that Secretary of Defense briefly summarized the impact of WikiLeaks on US diplomacy. Even those who point to foreign leaders moderating what they will tell the US know that that cannot last. As Secretary Gates put it, the fact is, governments deal with the United States because it is in their interest, not because they like us, not because they trust us, and not because they believe we can keep secrets. Is this embarrassing? Yes. Is it awkward? Yes. Consequences for US foreign policy? I think fairly modest. There is an overreaction because there is also a sense that this is a massive release of secrets. In fact, it is 250,000 ground reporting cables covering mainly a range of 5 years from 2005 to 2010. More than 130,000 of them are unclassified to begin with. 40% are confidential and 7% secret. Yes, it is true that some of the releases by WikiLeaks did not protect the security of individuals and might reveal legitimate secrets of national security. This is particularly enhanced because the 6,000 documents published by WikiLeaks are disproportionately more secret and confidential documents than they are represented in the whole cache. Among the 6,000 documents that WikiLeaks has published so far, a vast amount could have been declassified and could be in the public domain already. The government would have capitalized legitimately on such a transparent move. Slide 5. Among the WikiLeaks releases, you will find dozens of confidential and secret documents stamped to be declassified on or before 2010.
slide 6. We also have found documents that we have accessed through FOIA where 90% has been blacked out to us in our copy. Reviewing the WikiLeaks version, it shows that 95% of that document could have been released with no threat to national security. WikiLeaks shows that a large, current, pertinent, and sensible declassification is possible. We do not need to test our patience for the next 40 years or more to know what the government is doing on our behalf. Let us look at the dimension. Slide 7. On the right, you see the 250,000 cables by classification. On the left, the actual release by WikiLeaks on the site. Slide 8. Here you see what proportion is WikiLeaks of all the cables produced by the Department of State during a five-year period in the 1970s. Now, if you wanted all those documents from the 1970s declassified, take a note, because it will take you until 2046 to accomplish it. Slide 9. Finally, the tallest group in representing this graph, the actual number of cables produced by the Department of State between 2004 and 2009. Compare that to the productions in the 1970s and to the whole WikiLeaks. And finally, the last grouping, it shows that at today's technology and manpower capacity, it would take until the year 2165 for reviewers to declassify 80% of all the cables that have been produced in the last 5 years. It is a culture of close-mindedness, as that of the U.S. ambassador to Uruguay, that permeates government offices. Government officials are not used to deal with the consequences of their actions or their agencies in 4 years, or 8 years after an administration is over, not even 40 years. The culture is such that even embarrassment, an argument that we have used in FOIA cases to mock the reason for classification, has been wielded and publicly elaborated by some in this latest discussion on WikiLeaks that prestige is an important asset in national security. And embarrassment, of course, erodes prestige. This losing of perspective leads to an overreaction. In the context of the investigation of Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, the government has launched an aggressive series of secret subpoenas that have an intimidatory effect. Government officials are banned from browsing WikiLeaks, leading to the ridiculous situation that those wanting to report on the impact of WikiLeaks abroad can simply not perform their work. The whole security apparatus is up in arms. Diplomatic, political, security, judicial, intelligence task forces have been set up. Stanford J. Unger, a member of the President's Public Interest Declassification Board, captures the paranoid McCarthyist climate in his piece, Unnecessary Secrets, in the March-April edition of the Columbia Journalism Review, when he writes that one memorandum from the Office of Management and Budget warns of insider threats and urges that supervisors evaluate government employees for, quote, trustworthiness, unquote. Perhaps with the help of psychiatrists who can measure the level of unhappiness. And Unger concludes with this thought. Absent at least from the government public statement and actions is any consideration of an obvious underlying problem that the obsessive overclassification of U.S. official information has reached a point where it is impossible to know with confidence what truly deserves to be kept secret and how that can be done effectively. In the end, Unger continues, it may have been the unpredictability and loss of control in the WikiLeaks case that most rattled the bureaucracy. Good intentions and novel rhetoric notwithstanding, Obama officials have gone after more alleged leakers and government secrets than any other recent administration. The likelihood of success in such cases is low. The prospect of intimidation and suppression of public debate is high. In closing, Unger cites, and I close with this myself, he cites Erwin Greenswald, former Solicitor General of the United States, who under the Nixon administration tried to stop the publication of the Pentagon Papers. In 1989, a repenting Griswold wrote, it quickly becomes apparent to any person who has considerable experience with classified materials that there is massive overclassification, and that the principal concern of classifiers is not with national security, but rather with governmental embarrassment of one sort or another. There may be some basis for short-term classification, while plans are being made or negotiations are going on. But apart from details of weapon systems, there is very rarely any real risk to current national security from the publication of facts relating to transactions in the past, even the fairly recent past. Thank you.
Is this thing on?
Yes, it is. Hi, everyone. I'm James Jacobs. I am a stand-in, I guess, of sorts. I was just told about this morning. And what I'm going to talk about today is the role of the libraries in terms of WikiLeaks, as well as the library community's response to WikiLeaks so far. This was originally a talk that I gave several weeks ago at the Sunshine Week panel with Declan McCullough and Rainey Reitman of the EFF. And so some of the things I talk about, I don't know if they'll contextually fit with this, but I'll try. So to preface this some more, the work that I do, I'm a government documents librarian. I collect, preserve, and give access to government information as part of my mandate for the Federal Depository Library community, the FDLP library community, which, if you don't know, there are about 1,250 libraries to the center. How's that better? Sorry, I'll try not to mumble too. There are about 1,250 libraries, Federal Depository libraries, scattered around the country, public libraries, academic libraries, and anyone who needs government information can go into any Federal Depository library, whether it's a private library or a public library, and get access to government information. So come on down to Stanford if you want, or Berkeley's a depository library as well. I'm currently the chair of the Depository Library Council, which is the group that works with the public printer of the United States on libraries and government information issues. Although today I'm not a representative of the Depository Library Council, I'm speaking on my own. I guess that's something good for a lawyer crowd to say. First off, what are we doing at Stanford? As you know, the cables came out in early December 2010, actually about November 2010. As many in the mainstream media said, they were dumped on the internet, although I think that's obviously a misnomer. But right away, we cataloged the WikiLeaks site for our library catalog. And then in December, a group, the European Center for Computer-Assisted Research and the Dutch-Flemish Association for Investigative Journalists created a site called Cable Search, which, if you haven't seen, it's really great, cablesearch.org. And what they've done is they are indexing, they're capturing and indexing the cables as they come out. There's currently, and this was a couple weeks ago, they're currently indexing about 6,400 cables, which is about 2% of the total. The cables, and that's not Cable Search's fault, that's because WikiLeaks and the news organizations that are working with WikiLeaks are actually working to vet the cables and do due diligence, as they say, on the cables to assure that there's no privacy concerns or those kinds of issues. But Cable Search is really cool. It does an alert service. It's a full-text search. It has tag clouds of popular search terms, often used words or often searched for words, and an API, if there's any hackers in the room. But they have an API so that other developers can use the cables and can write programs to query their database and use it for different mashups and things. And I've already seen some folks, combine combine Google Maps with the cables to do sort of a mapping mapping interface for them. So what I'm doing personally is I'm periodically downloading the torrent, the BitTorrent file, which is a file that is put out by WikiLeaks, and it's every time there's a new cable released, they update this file, and you can download it and save it. I have not yet started to give public access to those through our library because there are there's some technical and policy issues, but I am downloading those for the library and plan on giving public access through our library site. So the community response, this is sort of the timeline of events when WikiLeaks was first put out the cables. There was a lot of chatter on several library listservs. Librarians are very interested in public information and very interested in collecting that information and giving access to users. At ALA, the American Library Association, there was a panel of discussions at the last midwinter, as well as several resolutions. Oftentimes, in ALA is a big library organization, and what they do is people within the organization write resolutions on action items for the ALA to do. And so there were lots of resolutions in support of WikiLeaks and saying what libraries should do. A lot of those resolutions didn't get passed for lots of reasons, good and bad. I wasn't actually at Midwinter, so I just heard about these discussions secondhand. Then a colleague of mine, Bill Sleeman, in early February, he's a documents librarian at the University of Maryland Law School, and he wrote an op-ed for the organization called the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin. And in this piece, he argued several things. He basically argued that the cables were stolen. His arguments were why libraries shouldn't deal with WikiLeaks or should hold back on WikiLeaks until more information is out there. But Bill's arguments, and I should note that he's a good friend of mine. We just disagree on this issue. His arguments were that the cables were stolen, released, and then dumped in an irresponsible manner, and that they were unauthenticated. That Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, that Assange's motivations were unclear. And that the WikiLeaks release of information could lead to the undesired effect of actually having less openness, less government transparency. In other words, Bill was looking at it from the perspective of whether or not libraries and librarians should support WikiLeaks. And he came to the conclusion that they should not. Now, I then wrote a piece. Bill's piece was called "A Librarian Reacts to WikiLeaks." And I wrote a piece on my blog that was later republished on the Center for Journalism Ethics as well. And my piece was called "A Librarian Reacts to a Librarian Reacts to WikiLeaks," sort of a Unix joke, I guess. And you can see that on freegovinfo.info. The URL is there. I hope you can see it. So I counter-argued that the cables were in fact leaked and not stolen, and they were released in conjunction with reputable organizations in a responsible manner and authenticated by the government's responses and actions following the leaks, and that a very small number had actually been leaked, not quote-unquote dumped. Let's see, that I was also arguing it in terms of what libraries should or shouldn't do. And so I argued that you can't base a collections decision, a library collections decision, solely on the classification status of information. And because if that were the case, then, there'll be talk later on today about the Pentagon Papers, but I don't know if folks know, but but actually the Pentagon Papers were not declassified until very recently. Yet, probably I would bet that nearly every library in the country has a copy of the Pentagon Papers, either the published book form, if not the congressional record, because a congressman, Mike Gravel from Alaska, he actually read a large portion of the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record, and every Federal Depository Library has those documents. And the last piece was that claiming that the release could cause harm is actually causing a chilling effect on libraries, because one could easily argue the opposite, that the cable release will not cause harm, but will in fact usher in a new era of government transparency. So both of these speculations purely muddy the waters, and they cause libraries to ignore the real question, which is what should libraries do about the leaks. I guess I should just send you my slides so that you can put them up on the site. I won't bore you, but I put out a library survey just to find out what libraries were doing, and actually I was quite surprised that many libraries had in fact not done anything about the WikiLeaks, and in fact there was a chilling effect based on things that had happened in the mainstream media and the coverage of WikiLeaks. But only three libraries out of the 70 that I surveyed had even cataloged the link to the site, and one of 70 are currently downloading the cables, and I'm the one. In case you couldn't figure that out. And only one other library had even had plans to download the cables. And then there was a 50-50 split on whether or not libraries should even preserve and give access to cables. So there's clearly something going on here that libraries, which are traditionally seen as protectors of civil rights and protectors of privacy and protectors of access to government information, there's definitely something going on here. More research needs to be done. And in closing, here's some of the survey responses that I get. I think that first one there is indicative of the both the chilling effect and sort of the cognitive dissonance that's going on in libraries. The cables are stolen goods. If someone left a box of stolen goods at my library door, I wouldn't accession them without the owner's consent. That said, I think libraries should preserve the digital content of the cables and seek permission from the owners to make them public. So I could go on and on, and I'll be around today, so if anybody wants to talk about libraries and government information, I'd be happy to talk more. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Closer. Yeah. All right. How's this? Even closer. There we go. All right, my name is Sarah Mohammed, and I'm going to be speaking about the diplomacy and deliberation side of the equation here. And on the diplomacy side, there's a lot of questions I could talk about. There's been a lot of discussion over the last few months about how the WikiLeaks document release, I'll call it instead of a dump, led last fall to all that we've seen since then. So how revelations about President Saleh affected the mobilization of protests in Yemen, how the release of cables about corruption in the Tunisian government led to the overthrow of that government. I'm going to talk about something else. I'm going to talk about how the release of these documents has impacted or may impact in the future the work of people in the State Department, in the U.S. government. I used to be one of those people. And in the course of that work, when I was at the State Department, I read, edited, cleared, and wrote cables probably every day. So what are these cables that we keep talking about? Cables are the primary channel by which embassies and consulates overseas communicate with Washington. They're also the primary means by which different diplomats inside Washington communicate with each other. These used to be telegrams, but the telegrams have been phased out, so now it's all electronic. So what makes these things different from email? A lot of people talk about them as if they are quite similar to email. People refer to them as group emails, but they are different. Cables are sort of a different beast. Cables don't go from one person to another person, or even from one person to a group of people. They're sent from office to office or from post to post. They're always signed by the ambassador if they're sent from overseas, or by the Secretary of State if they're sent from Washington, even if they weren't written by that person. Usually they're not written by that person. But that signature of the highest official in that place indicates that they carry the authority of that highest official. So a cable that's reporting on the state of affairs in Darfur, for example, might be sent from the American Embassy in Khartoum to the Secretary of State in Washington, and it might be copied to the American Embassy in Paris and in N'Djamena, because those embassies also have interests in what's going on in Darfur. So why not just send an email with all of this information instead? Well, for a few reasons. One is that cables are considered to be more official than emails. Cables are the traditional mode of communication in the State Department. So if you're sending something official, you put it in a cable. Now, what does this mean? What's something official? Presumably everything you're sending around when you're working for the State Department is official. What I mean by something official is anything of real consequence. And this doesn't necessarily mean anything that's classified. Lots of cables, as we know, are unclassified or contain unclassified information. So what does go in a cable? There's quite a range of functions. So cables can be character studies of foreign officials or rebel leaders or opposition party leaders or human rights activists. There could be reporting on recent events, whether acts of mass violence or protests or dinner parties. There could be analysis of the significance of those events, why they matter, where they might lead, how they implicate U.S. interests. There could be voting instructions for negotiations, what can be conceded and what absolutely cannot. There could be talking points for meetings with foreign officials or opposition leaders or the media. And none of this goes in an email, partly because of tradition. We've been doing this for a long time, and cables continue to be the way that people do things. But it's not only tradition. There are a couple of other reasons. One is that cables are more easily made part of the official record of the department than emails are. So emails require that a writer or a reader make that document a record, meaning an official part of the U.S. government's work. And that requires probably printing it out and putting it in a file. Whereas cables are automatically a part of that record. They're numbered, they're dealt with in a centralized system. Another part of this is that State Department diplomats and lawyers understand cables, as opposed to emails, as requiring a clearance. So this means that any office that has some interest in what's in this document has to sign off on it. That doesn't happen with emails. So cables necessarily represent a wider view than emails do. There's also, ironically, more security in cables. They operate on a different system, so you can't access a cable on a BlackBerry the way that you can access an email on a BlackBerry. Obviously, we all know that cables can still be shared. We're talking about the release of hundreds of thousands, potentially, of cables, not emails. But in theory, the cables are supposed to be more secure. Now, this is not to suggest that the cables are rigidly guarded. Cables aren't private communications from one person to another. So when they're sent to that embassy in Paris, any diplomatic staff with the appropriate clearance can take a look at that cable. And any person who's supposed to know that information, that analysis in the cable, will know the information and analysis in that cable. It's also expected that anyone who doesn't have a reason to look into that won't look into it. So these cables are the chosen means of communication, partly because things have been done this way for so long, but also because there seem to be some benefits to using cables. So how will things change? In his big piece about the process of how these documents came out, Bill Keller wrote in the New York Times that this release generated much breathless speculation that something, journalism, diplomacy, life as we know it, he writes, had profoundly changed forever. I can't speak about journalism or life as we know it related to these documents, so I'm going to stick to diplomacy. So what has changed or what will change? First, I'm going to address what I think won't change. So there have been quite a few suggestions that knowing there's a possibility that documents will be leaked will inspire diplomats to be more rigorous and more accountable in their work. Maybe. But I'm going to speculate that for most people, there is always a sense that the work can be at any time made public. Long before WikiLeaks happened, leaks happened, often. And the potential leak of one document is every bit as alarming as the potential leak of 100 for the person who's writing that cable or working on that issue. So the individuals who are working for the government should be, and I think, in my experience, are, considering the broader impact of their work, how that work will reflect on them, and how that work will reflect on their government. That said, we all know that there are times when individuals don't want to leave a paper trail, and in those situations, the easiest solution is to pick up the phone instead of writing something down. And it's possible that more leaks, bigger leaks, will mean that individuals are picking up the phone that much more often. But there are limits to this. In any big bureaucracy, eventually a policy needs to get written down. But I do think we should all consider the possibility that more disclosure might lead to more hiding of information along the way, but also consider whether that effect, if it's accurate, simply doesn't matter because on balance, more disclosure might ultimately be a good thing. Another possible consequence is that sources might be more reluctant to talk to the US government. And I'm not talking about government leaders who are afraid that their people will bristle at the idea of cooperation with the US government. As Carlos pointed out, as Secretary Gates noticed, U.S. leaders cooperate, or foreign leaders cooperate with the U.S. government because they need us, so maybe that won't stop. But I'm more concerned about human rights defenders who are providing information to the United States, who are seeking help from American diplomats. And as a number of human rights advocacy organizations have noted, we should all be concerned about the release of those individuals' names publicly. Some sources, like the New York Times, have been really good about redacting names. Other sources have not. Another possible consequence is that negotiations might be made more difficult if negotiating positions are disclosed. So if a document says, go if A happens, go with X, if B happens, go with Y, if C happens, go with Z, the US government's gonna have a really hard time saying, by no means can we accept option Z. So to the extent that these documents are being released as the events are still going on, that could cause problems. There could also be some changes for the better. I hope that these disclosures will lead to deeper examination within the State Department, within the rest of the government, that there are some problems with over-classification. If too much information is shielded, people within the government, organizations like WikiLeaks, might be more inclined to make that information public to feel less respectful of that classification, because that classification ultimately seems meaningless. It's just as Potter Stewart said to us all, when everything is classified, nothing is classified. Now, the opposite to that is that if too many people have too much access to information that's no concern to them, and I'm talking about people within the government, that information might more easily make it out of the building. So we might see more restrictions being put on which government officials can see and access which documents. One last consequence that I hope we'll see considered continued is something of a partnership that's developed, it seems, between the press and the US government. I am relieved to hear that members of the administration worked with the press to assuage some of the concerns they had about the disclosures, that they didn't attempt to use the courts to stop those disclosures. So I hope that is a signal for how this will continue in the future. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Steve Weber. Just a couple of ingredients of point of view from the perspective of political scientists looking at this as a treasure trove of potential research materials. I'll say I couldn't help but think, as Sarah was talking, as Stalin famously said of deaths, you know, one leak is a tragedy, a million leaks is a statistic. There's some truth to that, actually. Although it poses a really interesting big data problem that people will start to play around with, I think, in terms of managing those quite daunting numbers of cables. But let me tell you how I think about this from the perspective of a researcher and a little bit about the foreign policy community. There is a sort of threshold that something like this has to reach for me to feel that it is a really big deal in terms of the way people think about foreign policy, sort of revolution in diplomacy, like, say, the innovation and spread of the notion of extraterritoriality, where people decided that embassies were actually not a part of the land of the country on which they were based, because that was a useful innovation in foreign policy. I don't think we're quite there when it comes to WikiLeaks, and let me tell you why I think that. To my mind, the really important insight from what has happened for me has had very little to do with technology and much to do with the mindset around secrecy, and that is where I think we could learn. As Sarah said, diplomatic cables get stolen all the time. They've always been leaked, they've always been stolen. World War I, the Dreyfus Affair, you know, if you've ever seen the HBO series Rome. You know, this is scaled up massively. There's no question about that. The question is, does that make a difference? And I think the answer to that question really depends on where you stand on the mindset that that scaling phenomenon supports. And without cartooning it, I think there's sort of three ingredients to that mindset. And this is where I think, you know, we really ought to be having a discussion. Ingredient one, the belief that anything known by someone should be known by everyone. Is that true? Ingredient number two, secrets are bad. Secrets held by governments are particularly bad. Worse, say, than secrets held by individuals or by for-profit enterprises or mega philanthropies or all the other organizations and human beings that keep secrets from us. And third, and I think the really tricky and incredibly interesting question is the following one, or belief set. Transparency is the best and sometimes even a nearly automatic route to accountability. I think we have to dig into that assumption. Transparency is the best and a nearly automatic route to accountability. Those to me are the really big societal questions that are in play and that we should discuss as a group. But I'm going to take the last 5 minutes just to talk about the foreign policy issue, which is where I do most of my work. Does WikiLeaks and what it represents change foreign policy from the perspective of an outsider, someone who isn't in the State Department wants to study it? I agree with Sarah. I think on balance, this makes the job of your average foreign service officer and their equivalent in other countries a little bit harder, possibly a lot harder. And not only when it comes to human rights issues, but when it comes to the broad sharing of information that diplomats can get. Professional diplomats are remarkably honest with each other when they talk across hostile borders, outside the public limelight, as they thought they were pretty much doing in most of these cases. So, you know, it's no Saudis will express to Americans just how deep their growing fear of Iran really is. And Americans will tell Egyptians that they're really nervous about what a more representative electoral system will mean for Israel. None of this is a surprise to anyone in the foreign policy community. And actually, it's probably a good thing that those conversations happen. Yes, it's embarrassing when they are released. But the question to ask is, would the world be a better place? Would it be a safer place if diplomats couldn't share that kind of information with each other easily? So in the world that I work, most of the sort of models of international politics that I know suggest that actually it's missing or asymmetric information, particularly when it contributes to deep misunderstandings between countries when it comes to like what we like to call preferences or intentions, that stuff causes conflict, not peace. In other words, misunderstandings actually are bad for diplomacy. I mean, consider, as an anecdote, the 91 Gulf War. Right? Would more shared information between Baghdad and Washington have made that war more likely or less likely? For people who know the history, and particularly, you know, the apparent lack of transmission of Washington's deterrent threat via poor, maligned Ambassador Gillespie, that question sort of answers itself. More information would have been better. Having said that, I wouldn't worry too much because diplomats don't rely on international relations theory very much, thankfully, but they know that this kind of information exchange is incredibly valuable, and overall it tends to be much more stabilizing than destabilizing, so they'll find other ways to do it. Maybe the phone, maybe some other email system or so on and so forth. So there it is. Second, I agree with the view, and I think it's increasingly consensual, though not entirely so, that WikiLeaks probably will slow overall a movement towards declassification of national security docs. I remember in the days where there used to be these volumes in the library, they probably still exist, but I never actually go to the library to get them anymore, called the FRUS, the Foreign Relations of the United States. These were declassified cables. I believe the law is they were supposed to be declassified 25 years after, right? Now they've moved it to 30. Even when I was working in those documents some time ago, they were about 15 years behind because of the big data problem that you talked about. And when you got them, there were enormous amount of blacked out lines. It was kind of like, you know, reading stuff from the X-Files. The Clinton administration actually did a pretty good job of accelerating that. Interestingly, I think Carlos's slide demonstrated that the Bush administration, although they reversed the acceleration that took place in the Clinton administration, didn't go back as far as it had been before the Clinton years. The mindset started to shift a little bit, I think, and it moved from, look, you know, let's not have the default position be secret, but maybe have it be open unless you really need to keep it secret. That starting point reversed a little bit, but not as much as we might have expected under the Bush administration, and so that's good news. That represents a move towards openness. I think the risk is that trajectory now gets slowed down a little bit. You know, the simplest, quickest response to WikiLeaks, and government bureaucracies often do the simplest, quickest response to things, is to classify a lot more stuff as top secret, and that protects material at a much higher level inside differently encrypted networks that are harder to crack and are surely being hardened even further at the moment. It seems obvious that the default rule moves much closer, potentially, to, you know, when in doubt, make it top secret, than the other way around. And that wouldn't be a good thing. A rational response might be different, right? It might say, and it's easy for us to claim that, look, define a narrow, super high security swath of things you really need to protect. People might differ over exactly what the boundaries of that are, but they wouldn't differ enormously. And throw all your security resources at protecting that stuff and then just let the rest go. How many people in this room think that that's what the U.S. government's going to do? Right, but this isn't the conversation about should. This is a conversation about will. Third point. Maybe, just maybe, possibly if we help solve the big data problem, this stuff informs the interested public at a slightly higher level about the dynamics and complexities of diplomacy. There's a lot of risk in that. There's a lot of selection bias in the data that is coming out. We don't know what we don't know. But that's a hopeful ingredient. There are a lot of people in the world other than political scientists and foreign policy academics who are interested and intrigued by the give and take of international politics. Some of them actually may wish to see the sausage being made. Some of them may have interesting ideas about how to make that sausage better. I mean, Lord knows, the professional diplomatic corps is not exactly a volcano of innovation. And new ideas are certainly needed. And, you know, this is not a community that has much faith in the wisdom of the crowd or anything like that, but the possibility is there. Let me be clear about that. That's not something that the interested outsider is going to do well by looking at a small selection of leaked quotes in a Huffington Post article. Okay? You can't do this between subway stops. There's a huge corpus of information, and arguably, without trying to take the position of, you know, an expert who knows more than other, some background knowledge is needed to interpret this stuff in a meaningful way. So the availability of leaked cables, like lots of information, transfers not just information, but also responsibility from the professional diplomat to the public citizen. People rise to the occasion. I'm all for it, and I suspect a lot of professional diplomats would be all for it, too. Let me finish with a brief anecdote. Many years ago, I took a year off from the academic world to have a real job for a year just to see what it was like. And I worked as a consultant to the president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And part of my job was to write what would be the equivalent of cables inside that organization. And when I got there, I had to participate in a meeting that was designed to make a really important decision about the bank's policy going forward. Now, this is not a government. This is a multilateral development bank. The stakes aren't that high. My job was to write the background documents for that meeting, the briefing documents for that meeting. I went ahead and wrote the briefing document. I then sat in the meeting. I saw the way the decision came out, right? I don't know why that decision came out the way it did. But the one thing I know for sure is that it had absolutely nothing to do with what was in those documents. Because I wrote them. And I had a series of sleepless nights thinking as an academic who was going to go back to a research position and a research mindset, that 25 years from now, when those documents are released, you know, my non-existent son, God forbid, who would become a political scientist researcher, might read those documents. And the one thing I know for sure is that he would get it wrong. As you can imagine, that creates a kind of a self-doubt in the researcher's mind. I want to make sure that at least some of that self-doubt about the nature of what is in these documents and how they relate to real decisions is planted in the minds of those who read them on the web. Not to make you dispose of them as uninteresting, but to inject an element of caution into what we can and can't conclude from what we see. Thanks.
So we'll start off by trying to weave a little of this together. And as I said, folks in the audience who have questions, feel free to come up and ask some of those. But, you know, if we posit, you know, as what Steve had said, that the government's not going to do a 180 and default to open, and we go back to what Carlos has said with sort of showing this overclassification problem and the fact that if bodies and staff power is actually doing the effort of declassifying all this, some of this is going to take till 2156. And what James has said, that you all have only gotten through 2% of the cables using the kind of due diligence mm-hmm. that one might see. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what are some solutions inside the government from Sarah, and you know, some of the big data issues, like how can we actually maintain the ability for there to be communications, but in a way that we can make it transparent in a timely manner for transparency, for accountability, and also for the historical record, because I think that's a major issue right now, and we don't want to get into a situation where nothing is recorded, but we do want to be able to have information revealed in a timely manner. So, I mean, I know, Sarah, you probably can say more about this, but I've certainly heard from people within the government
you know, that when they send an email, there's an option, you know, top secret, classified, you know, open, and it's just easiest to pick the highest item, you know. And so how can we make some change within and then maybe talk about some of the big government, the big data issues as well?
I like the argument or the idea that Carlos proposed best, which is a short-term classification that can then be changed, because I tend to sympathize with that person who's clicking secret as something's happening. So negotiating documents, for example, I worked on a negotiation that was pretty difficult going into, and the document, the 20-page document that had the list of all of the things that we were debating was leaked to the New York Times, and there was a story on the front page of the New York Times the day we started the negotiations that got it wrong, that really characterized what was happening in these negotiations incorrectly. It raised a lot of anger about what was happening, and it made the work difficult, and I think ultimately it led to a worse result, and that was upsetting, because, you know, had that document been leaked 6 months later or released 6 months later, I think the impact would have been very different. So the idea of being able to put a hold on things for a week or for a month or some short period of time as they're happening, I think would make a huge difference. Because I genuinely don't think that the average person who's working on something for the government is thinking, you know, what can I do to keep this out of the public's hands for the next 30 years? All they're thinking is, how can I do my job right now and do it well? And so being able to do one's job well is, you know, might require some different kind of disclosure in that first week than it does 6 months later.
And do you think there would actually be sort of a technical way to do that, where you could actually code this as, you know, after this period of time, it's going to revert to this, so that you wouldn't have to, as a person, go back to do that?
I mean, it seems like there could be. So the system you talked about, the checking the box on the email, that's new. So that wasn't there when I was around. And that's brilliant. That's so much easier than printing out the email and putting it in the file and figuring out what to do with it later. So it seems like that would solve some of the concerns. I think the most immediate difficulty that comes to mind is that you don't always know the answer to that question. So right now, 6 months might seem like a great idea, but maybe in 2 weeks the issue's just dead. So why not declassify, release in a month instead of six? Or something could really blow up so that 6 months then seems like a terrible idea. So maybe some opportunity to revisit that along the way. But that, of course, requires a lot of manpower, and it sounds like that is a huge difficulty too.
Sounds like it should be part of the jobs bill.
That's a good point.
Thank you very much. When I heard about this, and I came rushing to make this from my bridge game, I thought that you would deal with the heinous charges of treason, treasonous behavior, the commanding officer of Bradley Manning calling for death for what he did, and the sexual slanders that have been contrived by the security forces for over 50 years in this country against Assange, and the spurious charges of rape and the danger to the American people, but I heard none of this. And also, I was hoping you would make a comparison to the real treason of the corporate elite during the Second World War, who almost all of them traded with the Nazis after the declaration of war, let alone before. And you're talking about Standard Oil of Jersey, General Motors, ITT, a Morgan Guarantee Trust, Morgan Stanley at that time, what became Citibank, which was called National Citibank. All this is left out. Those were the real traitors. These people just revealed at most crimes of our government. That should be a hero's. I should give a medal to Bradley Manning. And I have heard none of this. I've heard dyspeptic statistics. And I haven't heard how we can fight back against this growing arrogance and growing arrogation of power to the executive branch of the government and weakening all the other institutions of government. I'd like to hear you address that. Thank you very much for what you did. Bye-bye.
Well,
Can I speak? I'm going to speak for my fellow panelists on this point, and you can disagree with me if you want. I think that we will agree on the following two points. One is that the question of Julian Assange's motives are irrelevant to this discussion. Second, that the issue of how the leaker, Bradley Manning or other, is treated is tragic, illegal, but also fundamentally irrelevant to this particular discussion. We're not denying the importance of what you said. We're just talking about something different.
I think that one issue that is revealed a little bit in that question, and I know that Carlos tried to touch on a little bit and I think is an important piece, is, you know, the lack of transparency in the last decade, the slowness in terms of responding to FOIA, the efforts of the government to use state secrets to stop efforts in the courts. I mean, I think that's one important question to sort of think about and discuss. What really has been the impact of that on leading to something, or what has been the impact and the result, and is WikiLeaks related to that at all? Is it a bit of a byproduct of sort of a boiling point of lack of transparency? And what do we think about that? Because, you know, I work for the ACLU. I don't think it's a secret that we have been filing FOIA after FOIA after FOIA and case after case. And, you know, it's now de facto that we have to litigate a FOIA, where it used to be, you know, you filed a FOIA and that was the purpose of the FOIA, to get information. So what do people think about that and sort of the balance between transparency and accountability and that lack of balance that there has been?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. The balance is always an issue. And I'm a librarian, but I'm also an information activist, and I've worked, I think, very hard throughout my professional career to try and make as much government information accessible to the public, both pre-internet as well as post internet. My hope with the work that I'm doing is that whether or not cables continue to be leaked or not, or whether or not the State Department changes its policies on FOIA and those kinds of issues, these cables, if more libraries could give access to them and collect them and preserve them for the future, for researchers, for human rights activists, for independent media journalists. I see an IMC person in the corner there. That's basically what my work is about, is to try and give as much access so that other activists, other folks can do the work that they need to do to shine light on government activities.
I think there are a lot of reasons that people are interested in these documents. I think some of it is just that it's fascinating to see how many of them there are. There are people who want to see the sausage being made. I think there's certainly a sense of comeuppance also, that the government has spent much of the last 10 years arguing state secrets in national security cases, and I think there's some response to that it's about time we're seeing some of these documents, and also a sense of ludicrousness in some of these arguments also, that where documents have accidentally been made available to litigants and then they're no longer available, they're still classified despite the fact that everyone knows what's in them. A sense that we're in this through the looking glass world on what these documents are and how we're allowed to use them and how we're allowed to talk about them. I think that makes respect for classification or any sense that there's a reason for this happening, it makes it really hard to buy that. So I think there's probably a connection there, at least for some people.
Can I say something?
Carlos, did you have a final statement?
I just want to say something. Listen, I have been hearing to everything and it sounds very interesting, but it has been classified to me 95% because I can hear you very distorted. I'm sorry. But anyway, it seems very interesting. I just want to comment on what you were saying. Why we have to deal with so much more classification and going to litigation. I think that there's no doubt that we have crossed the threshold in the past 8-10 years because of 9/11. Many people cross thresholds. The government crossed thresholds by spying on citizens, by torturing foreigners, by bringing them illegally. We're still having them. I mean, the legal framework for this is still in question. And we actually, even activists, have also kind of surrendered some of the prerogatives to the government. I think that has happened because of the paranoia. I remember myself, I was like 5 blocks across from the Pentagon on the Potomac when the planes fell there. So there has been insecurity and I think wimpiness, if you want, I don't know how to say the weakness, on our part to really counter what has happened in the latest years. And that I see reflected also in today's position of us, many of us in this room, towards the WikiLeaks cables. We're not discussing them, we're not copying them. Libraries don't want to catalog them because they are classified. Who says so? The government. Excuse me? The Pentagon papers are classified? Yes. Remember, the CIA and all the whole establishment insist they are classified. So you are making transactions with classified material. Somewhat or somehow we are committing a crime. It is not so. There is all this intimidation and we are letting ourselves be intimidated, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I unfortunately we're out of time, but I think that one thing that can be a benefit from all of this on either side has been, you know, a wake-up call to all of us about how much information is not being revealed by the government and for us to be working together in whatever aspect to try and increase transparency when appropriate, and to find the right balance between transparency and accountability and diplomacy and deliberation, which in my opinion is out of balance right now. And perhaps there are many different ways that we can try and get that balance back through oversight, through better mechanisms, and maybe even through technologists helping us to solve some of this problem of big data. So, hopefully we'll have the rest of today to talk about more of these issues. And of course, we will be here to answer questions and to talk to you all later today. So thank you very much.
Thanks. So we're going to transition to the second panel right away. We're not actually going to take a break now, but we're going to give you one at about 4:30, and then there'll be a break till 5. And then the final panel. But if you need to use the restrooms, they are right outside and there's a cafe, so feel free to kind of move back and forth as you need to. While I just wanted to note, in response to the one question too, that the three panels have been sort of segmented into different subject matters, so I do think we're actually going to get to some of those more political activist questions as well as we go along, so don't despair. So just give us a few minutes here to transition to the next panel, then we'll get going in probably 5 minutes.